You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This week, we're spending an hour one-on-one with the main candidates for governor. Yesterday, Jeff Johnson was in the studio. Tomorrow, Tim Walz will be here. Invitations are also out to former Governor Tim Pawlenty and Lori Swanson. Hopefully, we're working on scheduling some dates. Today, State Representative Aaron Murphy is here, and we're inviting your questions. As you think about this, is there an issue that's particularly important to you in your neighborhood, in your household, maybe at the business you own or work in, that you want Representative Murphy to prioritize if she's elected governor? Younger voters, I heard from a lot of you yesterday, open the phone lines, would like to be noticing that you're engaged in this race. And I think we got that yesterday. But feel free to call voters 35 and under. You're paying attention. And for everyone, that idea of the issue that really motivates you as a voter, that means something to the business that you own or work in, the household that you live in, the neighborhood that you live in, think about that and call in. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Welcome. Good to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Carrie Miller. It's good to be here.
I want to talk about health care with you. You wrote an editorial earlier this year about health care in which you advocated for single-payer health care, and we'll describe exactly what you mean by that and how that would work. But in the editorial, you said, we must make strategic and difficult choices with valuable resources, putting the health of Minnesotans ahead of health insurance profit making. So I'd like you to speak specifically to the role that you think insurance companies have played in the expense and, I would assume, what you think is the mismanagement of the current healthcare system that we have, if you're advocating for single payer. What have the health insurance companies done that you think is a problem?
I am really glad that we're starting there, because as I have been talking with Minnesotans in the course of this race, and have been in this race now for about 20 months, this is a top of mind issue for people, and they are both frustrated and worried about the amount of money that they have to pay for their own health care despite having health care insurance. And they're paying out of pocket for deductibles and for drug costs and for premiums and, frankly, for surprise billing that they don't necessarily consent to. So I have been talking about healthcare now for 26 years. I'm a registered nurse, and I do think it's time for us to lead the nation like we did 26 years ago when we passed Minnesota Care and get on a pathway to single payer. When we moved an issue in the 2015 session, reinsurance in the individual market, the state spent almost $900 million to reinsure health insurance companies because the individual market was weakening. Governor Dayton at the time had proposed a Minnesota Care buy-in, and with the fiscal note that came in this next year showed that that would have cost us about $150 million. When we appropriate money to the health plans and they set up contracts with providers, we don't see anymore where that money goes because it's considered not public, it's private, and it's proprietary. So we don't really know where the dollars are going, but there is a lot of money, state dollars, that are going to the health plans and not into health care. And that's where we need to find our savings. And that's where we need to go to redeploy those dollars back into health care to providers to do the job that they want to do, that they are supposed to do, to make sure that Minnesotans are getting the care that they need and expect.
Just to be clear here, the Affordable Care Act, insurers supported that. They met with President Obama when he was creating the details of that. Insurers want this to work, right? Because it's supposedly going to bring more people in to be covered. What is it specifically that you think they're doing with the money that is inappropriate or needs more scrutiny or leads you to say, of all of this, the insurers are really the problem here?
So from my perspective, and I've now been through a series of reforms in my career, starting with Minnesota Care back in 1992, we've done major reforms or attempts at reforms. And when those settle, the market interests come behind that and find their footing. That is what has happened behind the Affordable Care Act. And there's two things that are happening right now with the ACA. So first and foremost, we built the Affordable Care Act on the current private and public system. So yes, the insurers were interested because we the federal government created an individual mandate and said you have to buy insurance. That meant the insurance companies were going to get more participation,
right? Right.
And then we've watched, especially under this current administration, the effort to try and undermine pieces of that, which have weakened the insurance marketplace for people.
The Trump administration.
That's right.
But what have the insurers done to undermine it?
So when the Trump administration started to monkey around with some of those provisions, then the insurers came and said, we need extra help. We need reinsurance, and fought against the buy-in to Minnesota Care, which was another really clear option for people. But this is what I think is important, Carrie, right? The market finds its footing behind a big significant change, and they have. And insurance companies, pharmacy benefit managers, drug companies, they have their own ability to make money off of the system. That's why they're there. The insurance companies demanded almost $900 million from the state of Minnesota to stay in the individual market without making a commitment to the people of Minnesota that they would lower the rates or expand the networks or increase access for people. I struggled with that. I opposed that. They also said that in that deal, we need to make sure that for-profit insurance companies can sell in Minnesota, which was we were the last state in the nation to have not-for-profit status for our health plans in the state of Minnesota. And we gave that up, which from my perspective was something that we lost in that debate. And I think that we can find a much stronger path forward for people by giving them an option.
Which is the single payer.
Right.
And how does it work in your view?
I want to describe a pathway, and it's important that we talk about it as a pathway because Minnesotans are worried about losing what they have right now. I want to let anybody who chooses to buy into Minnesota Care, anybody in the state.
You would cut out the insurers as the middlemen, right?
Yes. And I put a provision into law in 2010 that allows the state to contract directly with providers. And the Dayton administration has used it sparingly. It saved the state a couple $100 million as they've used it. I have faith in our providers that they will do their very best job to care for people, and we will get better value out of those dollars when we contract directly with providers. We need to set up that infrastructure. We need to strengthen it. But we have the means in law already. We put that into law in 2010 in the wake of the reforms that we were working on in 2008 and 2009 and 2010. I also think we need to use the power of purchasing here in the state of Minnesota to get a better deal on drug costs. And we can do that through the Department of Administration. There is a young man, a family that I met, the Smith and Holt family, a young man named Alec, and he was 26 years old. He aged out of his parents' insurance. He was an insulin-dependent diabetic. He had a full-time job. He couldn't afford his drug costs. He couldn't afford that deductible that got him his insulin. So he rationed his insulin, and he lost his life. At 26 years old, he died because he couldn't afford a drug that has been on the market since the 1920s. The drug companies are making a tremendous amount of money on insulin right now, and they can. There's not a check on that power. There's not a check necessarily on our insurance companies here in the state of Minnesota.
I want to ask you about premiums here before we take some calls. A moment ago, talked about rising premiums. You know that premiums were going up quickly before the ACA, but you also know that premiums continue to rise, not as at quick of a pace, but they do continue to rise. Can you say today, well, if we had single payer, I can ensure families who buy into Minnesota Care that there will not be increases the way we're seeing them on premiums? Or can you not say that? Because what we've seen is that premiums continue to go up.
In 2014, I passed the Health Insurance Transparency Act, which created essentially a public competitor to the commercial offerings in the negotiations on school employee health insurance. And it has shown when you have a public competitor, in this case, it's the public employee insurance plan, that is a part of the competitive bidding process while they're negotiating their contracts. It is driving down the costs of the offerings by the commercial insurers because now they're competing with a public offering. It has made a difference in terms of school employee health insurance costs and for property taxpayers for the school districts across the state, and we need to continue to do that.
So that I understand this, you're saying that a single-payer option would act as kind of a damper when it comes to premiums on the market as a whole.
Yes.
Competition-wise, it would encourage the health plans to dial back on the premium increases because they'd have to compete with the single payers.
I think we have to give Minnesotans a choice, and Minnesota Care would be that choice. And we can show them that we can offer comprehensive, high-quality health care across the state of Minnesota, contracting with the providers to make sure that the distribution of health care is something that we can assure. Because right now there are networks that are holding people out. There are parts of the state that are no longer delivering babies. Mayo, down in the southeastern part of the state, is starting to close hospitals. I was in Gibbon, Minnesota, 3 or 4 weeks ago, talking with a group of small farmers. And a gentleman there broke into tears because he said, there are two physicians in our facility here that are preparing to retire. And I don't know that we're going to get two more physicians. And I'm afraid that the Mayo, who controls this, is going to close this facility.
So let's say you're the governor. What do you say to Mayo about closing hospitals? You can't do that?
I think that they are going to have to prove to us why it is important for them to close that hospital. There are nearly 18,000 people that live in Albert Lea. And there are a lot of seniors. They have a disproportionate number of aging citizens in that community who are going to go from their skilled nursing facilities to the hospital in that community. And if they have to go from their skilled nursing facilities to the hospital in Rochester or Austin, that's not going to work very well
so
for that family.
So just so I'm clear about how this might work, you would say to Mayo, you need to open the books and show us why you're making a business decision to close this hospital in this
community. I think instead
community.
I would say that we're going to be contracting directly with providers, and we're going to make sure in that contract that care is distributed across the state. That's how we're going to do it.
And that means to Mayo,
That means to Mayo, how you have this big network down here. You have acquired all of these facilities. How are you going to make sure that the people in your network are going to get the care that they need? Under the law in the state of Minnesota, let's set up a contract that delivers on that.
State Representative Aaron Murphy and DFL endorsee for governor is in the studio with us. We're talking one-on-one. We've, of course, started with health care. She's got a lot of experience as a nurse. It's an issue that she's been immersed in at the state legislature. But opening the phone lines now for you for questions about the issue that is key in your household, in your neighborhood, in the business that you work in. If you're in the healthcare field, I'd like to hear from you too. I think it'd be interesting to hear your questions and follow up on what you have to say. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieMPR. I'll get to a number of these Twitter questions here, but to the phones to Carolyn in Apple Valley. Hi, Carolyn. You're a doctor, is that right?
That's right. I'm an OBGYN here in the Twin Cities.
Glad you called. What do you want to talk about?
I just wanted to say thank you to Erin, first of all, and give a shout out to Erin Mayquaid, who is my representative down in Apple Valley.
She's great.
But also say that I really appreciate the conversation being focused on insurance companies, because as a physician, I've been in practice for more than 7 years now. You know, my goal is to provide the best care that all of my patients can afford. And one of our issues with Obamacare is that it gave the insurance companies all of the power. It guaranteed everybody health insurance, but it didn't guarantee them health care. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do in our group is contract directly now with certain companies to give our patients affordable access to surgery, for example, or prenatal care that they can bundle, because we have great outcomes, especially surgically. And right now, for example, Blue Cross will pay me 20% less than another provider who's providing the exact same level of care, but with a higher complication rate or poorer outcomes, just because the insurance company can contract cheaper with a company that physician might be employed by. And that's not good for patients at all.
So Carolyn, I want to be clear here. You see the health insurers as acting as what kind of role in the system we have now? Not invested in delivering the highest quality care at the most effective price. I mean, what role do they play that you find worth critique of as a physician?
You know, right now they act as profit-making entities. So they are a business. They have shareholders. They have CEOs that they compensate. They are trying to make money by that's what insurance is fundamentally. Taking low-risk people and taking constant streams of income to occasionally cover catastrophes. And in healthcare, our goal is to provide care to citizens and allow people to have the care they need to live healthy lives. It shouldn't be to give them an out just in case something bad happens. But other than that, you're on your own.
Okay.
And health insurance companies are private for-profit industries. They are not in this the way providers are. They are not in this the way the state is, which is to help care for patients, to give patients what they need.
Carolyn, I really appreciate the call and the thoughts there. You've raised something that I wanted to ask Representative Murphy about. Yesterday, when Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson was here, we talked about his idea of where health care coverage ought to go. And one of the things that he suggested was we should allow people to only have insurance for if this is what they want, to only have insurance for catastrophic health events. And I asked him, well, what happens to the family where somebody gets a diagnosis of cancer? It's not an emergency. You're not going into the ER for that. But this is going to cost a lot of money for your health care coverage. And he said he didn't. That's where we create this high risk pool. But government should not be in the business of requiring people to have insurance that they don't want to have. What do you think of that plan of catastrophic and high risk pool?
So first of all, I want to thank Carolyn for jumping on and sharing her story from a perspective of a physician. We have explored this option over the years, this idea that we, you know, just do catastrophic, let people make a choice. And it invariably ends up costing the system more money. And the example that I like to talk about is when we took Governor Pawlenty to task on his line item veto of general assistance medical care, which was an expensive health care coverage program for people who made $8,000 a year or less. And as we explored options to restore that funding, and in the end, we actually did beat him and turn him around on that. What we saw was when we released people who were sick, or we pulled back on coverage, it ended up costing the system much more money because people who were sick or people who weren't sick but became sick still got care in our system, but they got it in episodes. They got it in a less efficient manner, and their outcomes were worse. So this idea that each of us as individuals are going to take responsibility for this, which is, you know, a fundamental value that many, many people share across our country, right? We all have individual responsibility. When we put that up against the shared values of we're going to care for each other, which is alive and well in the state of Minnesota, I hear this from Minnesotans all the time. We care about each other. We're going to fight for each other. Healthcare providers are not going to turn somebody away because they don't have a means to pay. But for someone with a chronic condition, not an emergent condition, but a chronic condition like diabetes, like Alec, or somebody who shows up with cancer, right, who's going to require ongoing care, someone's going to pay for that. And if that person doesn't have coverage, those costs get dispersed across the system. And that's how we see rising costs, rising premiums for everybody. And if we had a system that accounted for the fact that we are all going to encounter a healthcare crisis at some point, you know, whether it is we need our gallbladder out, we're going to have a baby, we get cancer, or some other experience, we're going to use the healthcare system. We have to pay for that.
Call here from Joe in Rose Creek, Minnesota. Hi, Joe. Thanks for waiting.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say that for 5 years, I worked as a subcontractor in Rochester for the Mayo Health System. And you know that they're a tax exempt, I don't know what you want to call them, a company or a business, but if the Mayo Health System is not for profit, I am grossly been deceived because they are, and they don't pay taxes in our state or our city, and they expect our tax dollars then to build this destination medical center. And they do close our hospitals here. We have nursing homes that don't have a doctor within 30, 40, 50 miles. Those places are going to close because people just won't go there. The rural is being forgotten.
Representative, what else do you want to say about Mayo since Joe brings it up again?
So we are, you know, the benefactor of so much of what Mayo is able to do in terms of health care. But I do feel that they need to restore some of their connection to the values of Minnesotans around care.
What does that mean?
So when there have been a number of issues, you know, the Albert Lea issue, the closure of that hospital is a good issue. And Mayo does, they take on high risk, high cost patients, right? So the distribution of those costs in the southeastern part of the state of Minnesota is an issue in that part of the state that we should think about distributing more generally. But when they subcontract or send people who have worked for them for more than 40 years, and I'm thinking about their food service people, their dietitians, they say, we don't want, this is not our line of business anymore. So you've worked for us for more than 40 years, but we're going to have you become an employee of another organization that we're going to contract with, and you're going to lose some of your stature and your benefits with this organization because we just don't want to do that anymore. When they lock people out at Christmas time in Albert Lea, the employees at that hospital did a one-day strike, and they locked them out for the balance of Christmas week. That tells me that their interests, their corporate interests, are overriding their community interests. And that, I think, is something I hope they pay attention to. I'm paying attention to that. And people in the southeastern part of the state are very, very clear. And you just heard it from Joe. This concern that the corporate interest, the business model, is overtaking Mayo's longstanding commitment to healthcare and to its community is a problem for people.
On Twitter, a listener says, as someone who has had a handful of pre-existing conditions, healthcare has always been important to me. Obamacare made it so that I had to spend a deductible of $6,000 before I could get any actual coverage. How might your planned system change this? On deductibles.
So, I'll say this again. The United States of America built the Affordable Care Act on the current system that cost shifts between private and public. And the market interests have come behind the Affordable Care Act and have taken advantage of the law. I am seeing, in a way that I've never seen before in Minnesota, deductibles, surprise bills, drug costs that are unfettered. There's a woman that I know who has good insurance. She had a brain tumor. She had surgery for that brain tumor. There was a surgeon that was out of her network that participated in that while she was asleep. She didn't consent. She saved it. They saved her life, right? It was a serious brain tumor, but she got a $30,000 bill that she didn't anticipate that is out of pocket for her. The deductibles on an insurance plan are the reason why Alex Smith couldn't afford his insulin, and they're allowed, right? When I think about Minnesota Care and the structure of Minnesota Care, it's a premium-based system. The premiums are based on a sliding fee scale. They always have been for 26 years. People at the top of that scale pay full premium price, but it's like $400 or $500 a month at this point. We can find a better deal for the people of Minnesota, just like we did with the Health Insurance Transparency Act. Well, when we did that in 2014, we can do this very same thing with Minnesota Care and making it an option for Minnesotans to buy in. They'll get good comprehensive care that's affordable across the state.
Call here from Holly in Minneapolis. Hey, Holly. Hi. Thanks
Hi.
For waiting. Good question.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Erin, I'm a very big supporter of yours, so thank you for taking the time to talk about the issues. I actually have two questions for you. My first question is, what is your position on the legalization of recreational marijuana? And could you please respond to Jeff Johnson's view on this subject and how he believes that there are essentially like no benefits of legalizing marijuana, and that legalizing marijuana would tell children that drugs are okay? I will take my call here.
Representative, let's hear Jeff Johnson from yesterday in a discussion about his views on legalizing marijuana. Here he is.
The argument I hear all the time is, well, pot is no worse than alcohol. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I think you could probably make a case either way. But it's clearly seen as an illegal drug in a way that alcohol is not. And what this would say to people is that there truly is no harm to be had. And there is.
So he supports legalizing medical marijuana, but not legalizing recreational marijuana. What do you think about his view?
Well, I'll start by saying that I would sign into law the legalization of recreational cannabis, but it has to include legislation that is clear about the expungement of records for people who have served. And I think we should also contemplate what it means for people who have been incarcerated for nonviolent cannabis crimes. And the reason why I support it is because There is a disproportionate number of people of color, especially men of color, who are incarcerated for this crime. And we know, and Minnesota prides itself on being at the top of all sorts of lists, but we are at the top of the list, number two in terms of racial disparities. And that's in health and outcomes, education and outcomes. It's in incarceration rates and criminal justice and earning power for women of color, for indigenous women. We don't want to be at the top of this list. And we have to take meaningful action to change that. And this is one way to do it. This is one place where we can make that meaningful change. So I worked on the legislation around the legalization of medical cannabis. It was a very, very difficult and hard-fought win for families who had brought their sick children to the Capitol for an entire session. Scott Dibble and Carly Moline were the authors of that legislation. They did tremendous work, and I worked with Carly behind the scenes. And it taught me a lot about the issue of medical cannabis, about the advancements that we're making around the science and what it means for people with chronic conditions. I believe that now. I also think that it is time for us, and I think Minnesotans are ahead of policymakers on this question about recreational cannabis, and they are ready to make this move. And if the legislature puts it on my desk, I'll sign it into law.
So just so I understand your philosophy here, it is really more about the criminalization, the consequences of the criminalization, and less about your belief that, you know, you're somebody who can make decisions about the kind of substances you want to indulge in. I want to understand if you think, yeah, I mean, if this is something that you want to do, indulge in a drug, then who am I to say you shouldn't be able to do this? Where is your philosophy on this?
Well, I think as I listened to Jeff Johnson in that tape, right, he's making the comparison to cannabis and alcohol. I would say there's ample evidence to suggest to us that the prohibition on the use of cannabis has not really reduced the rate of use of cannabis, but instead it is a black market activity, and it is resulting in the incarceration of especially black men. And I think we should pay attention to that. I disagree with Jeff Johnson. I do believe that alcohol has health risks. Cannabis has health risks. Smoking cigarettes has health risks. If we legalize cannabis, it has to fall under the law of freedom to breathe, just like we do with tobacco. I think we have to think about kids and their access. Absolutely. And I know pediatricians, and I've talked with them about their concerns about access to cannabis for young people with developing brains, but they already are getting access. And we may have a better shot. I think we would actually have a better shot at keeping it out of the hands of young people if it is regulated and legal.
Erin Murphy is the DFL endorsee for governor, state representative. We're taking your calls and your questions on this and some of my questions in our hour-long one-on-one ahead of the August primary. 651-227-6000 on the issue that motivates you as a voter, that's really important to your neighborhood, to your community, to your household, to the work that you do. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Right back to the phones here to Will in St. Louis County. Will, is that right?
St. Louis Park. St.
Okay.
Louis Park.
Hey, hi. Good to have you on the line. What do you want to ask?
Hello. You know, Minnesota has always been known as being a state with very strong support for education. I had a really amazing experience in my own education through that PSEO program where I got to spend my senior year at MCTC. And I really have so much respect for community colleges. Mm. They're one of the places where the American dream and social mobility is still alive. And I was wondering if the candidate would support making community college free and how else she would support community colleges around Minnesota, in the Twin Cities and in the greater Minnesota.
Okay, so you're asking about making community college free. Representative?
Thanks, Will, for the call. And we, you know, it would not take very much of our state dollars to make community colleges free for anybody who wants to go to school there, because we've done so much work to support them already. So yeah, I'm way open to that idea. Our community colleges across the state are an awesome deal in terms of the first years of your education, in terms of getting an associate degree and getting into the workforce, in terms of your hands-on trades experiences. And there are strong partnerships with employers, manufacturers, the ag industry, the healthcare industry, and our community colleges across the state, which create a ready pathway to the workforce that we're going to need. And we know we already have a workforce shortage. In many ways, that's going to be exacerbated by the baby boom generation that is retiring from our workforce today. So our community colleges are a real asset for us. We need to strengthen, I think, the relationship between our K-12 schools, especially around trades, the skilled trades, and our community colleges and the apprenticeship programs that our trades already offer, to make sure that, you know, anyone who wants to, and really I think in the economy of our future, people are going to need a post-secondary education of some sort, whether it is at a community college, through the trades, or at a university here in the state of Minnesota. And we have to make sure that that is affordable and accessible for people. And I'm so happy to hear about your experience with PSEO. I know as a parent, that's a really important feature for people here in the state of Minnesota, and I'm glad that it's working for you.
You do sound like you're committing a lot of taxpayer money to programs and projects that you're endorsing even here. I mean, you're talking about free community college, talking about expanding MinCare. Where's the money come from?
So, you know, I have served now for 12 years in the legislature, the first four with Governor Tim Pawlenty, who, when he left office, left Minnesota with a $6 billion budget deficit. And with Governor Dayton, when I was the majority leader, we put that budget back together again. And that structural balance is so critical to our ability to plan our future. I hope I am lucky enough to be a governor for 8 years. And having a structurally balanced budget, while it doesn't sound very sexy, is really critical to our ability to begin to plan for our future.
Which
when
means
we think about Minnesota Care and a buy-in.
So balanced budgets mean if you're going to spend, you have to find the money from somewhere else.
You
so
do.
How do you do that?
You do. And I've got a lot of experience with that budget, right? I've been through the Great Recession. I've had experience when we've done budget cutting. I've had experience when we've cut taxes, when we have raised taxes. For me, the critical piece for me is setting our sights on the priorities for the future of Minnesota, and then moving a budget that actually moves those priorities. And one of the things that I hear from Minnesotans a lot, they're frustrated. They feel like the issues that are important to them just aren't getting addressed by a government that's too focused on winning the next election, too focused on beating the other side. And we got to bring Minnesotans' powerful voices back to bear on the issues that matter to them and then focus on them. On healthcare, Carrie Miller, we spend a tremendous amount of money in healthcare right now. It's just not being spent on care. So let's redeploy those resources. And as I said, on community colleges, we're really close already to free community college for everybody. So it is not a significant outlay of new dollars. But, and I want this to be really clear for your listeners, a balanced budget is a high priority for me, because when we're chasing deficits, it means we're not looking ahead and we're not planning our future. So it will balance. My budgets will balance.
Do I hear you saying, hey, Minnesotans, if you want this, if you think these are priorities, expanding Minnesota Care, free community college, some of the other things that you've been talking about, it would be fair to ask you to chip in a little more? I mean, could you say to Minnesotans, we may need more of your financial commitment to make some of these things happen?
Yep, I think that's right. When you think about transportation, and the fact that we haven't, since we overrode Governor Pawlenty's veto back mm-hmm. in 2008, we haven't really made a meaningful investment in transportation. And I get asked questions about that all over the place. And I think that sometimes people who are running for office are afraid to say out loud, this is what I'll do. We do need to raise a dedicated tax for transportation if we want to invest in transportation, roads, bridges, and transit.
Is that the gas tax, or what is that?
It would be a gas tax or another user fee that is attached to transportation. And when I hear the frustration in the people of Minnesota who say, everybody keeps talking about doing this in transportation, but nobody's willing to do the work, that's where people lose faith in our capacity to actually make progress for their communities. And I want to fix that. We need, in a healthy democracy, to have Minnesotans engaged in having some faith in our capacity together, not just inside the Capitol, but Minnesotans together, to build our future using this powerful tool, our democracy.
Call here from a school board member in Duluth. Hi, Sally. Thanks for waiting. Good to have you on the line.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. My question for Representative Murphy has to do with, just similar to along the lines of Will's question and what you're just discussing now, recognizing that public education is critical to the long-term success of our communities and our state, what are your plans for redeploying resources to public education to make up for the deficits that many school districts are facing now? And specifically, what are your plans to address the gaps with special education services?
Wow, that's a big question.
It sure is. Again, an issue, education, that Minnesotans across the state value. They understand the role of education in their own family's well-being. They understand the role of education in our economy. They understand that a well-prepared workforce means that people from other parts of the world and other parts of this country will come to Minnesota. Employers will come and start their businesses in Minnesota because we're ready to do the work. So for many, many reasons, education has always been and will continue to be a centerpiece for Minnesota's success. And we are behind in terms of funding. And I have watched in my 12 years the kind of games playing, political games playing around education that is frustrating for me. And I know it's frustrating for schools because for schools and for school districts and for school board members, they're never sure what's going to happen by the end of the session. And often education becomes a leverage point at the end of the session, especially in these last few years. That's frustrating, and that's not going to happen. I don't want that to happen when I am the governor for the state of Minnesota. We need to continue to invest, and I've heard loud and clear about special education. It's a federal obligation that they're not meeting, and they haven't for many, many years. But when we don't fund special education, the funding for that comes out of other resources intended for our schools. I want to make sure that we close the opportunity gap. That is a key priority for me, and that's not just money. That's about models of teaching. That's about teachers of color, and it is about making sure that kids coming into school are ready. So making sure that our early childhood sphere is well coordinated, that it's durable and it's reliable, so kids who are going through childcare and who are in pre-K are getting the very best start, that women are getting good prenatal care, that Head Start is available. Making that investment in early education, and we spend a lot of money there, but it's not very well coordinated. So let's tighten that up to make sure that communities understand what they have. So kids are coming to school ready to learn, that our K-12 system is funded adequately, that we're paying attention to teachers of color, to full-service community schools, which I think is an empowering model, and to recognize that across the state, when we rely on property taxes, we're getting uneven results in different communities. And we're seeing the pressure on some of our schools, both in rural Minnesota and in places like Minneapolis and St. Paul, that are really struggling because of a property tax base that is not in a position to meet the demands of the schools. We got to pay attention to that as well.
Representative, you were there in the legislature when concealed carry was passed, right? I'm trying to remember how long ago. No, I
wasn't there.
Okay.
It happened before I was
before
there.
Before you.
Yeah.
Do you think it works pretty well, the law?
Wow, I did my first work on gun violence prevention in 1999 when I joined the board of an organization called Citizens for a Safer Minnesota. It's now Protect Minnesota. And it was my first introduction to the very polarizing, very powerful voice of the gun lobby in our politics and in the legislature. And, you know, it was after I came off that board, but before I was elected, that the state passed the conceal and carry law. I think that we have moved in Minnesota in a significant way around this issue, and Minnesotans are no longer just expressing their support for common sense gun safety prevention like universal background checks and the red flag laws that have been debated across the country, but they're also expressing a real frustration that the things that they know Minnesotans across the state support aren't getting any attention inside the Capitol.
I hear you on that, but do you believe that conceal carry, it is the law of Minnesota, works as it should, or would you try to repeal it?
I am more interested in looking at the background check issue, the red flag law, restoring our ability to look at the intersection between gun violence and gun safety. I'm the author of that piece of legislation, so we can think about this from a public health perspective. And I think it's time for us to think about the prohibition of future sale of assault weapons in the state of Minnesota.
I am not
interested, and I haven't proposed a repeal of conceal and carry.
You believe that the law should stay as it is.
I would
enforce.
So one place where I would consider a change in that is the way that guns are considered inside the state capitol right now, because there is a way that you can carry a concealed weapon inside the capitol, but it's not a public list, and I have concerns about that inside the capitol. But of the where I am concerned about gun violence prevention and the places where I think we should intervene, that is not a law that I have contemplated changing.
Okay. Call here from Audrey in Minneapolis. Hey, Audrey, hi. Your question.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. I'm calling about the Twin Metals Project. I want to know if you will uphold Governor Dayton's moratorium on the new leases in the Boundary Waters watershed, and do you support the Twin Metals Project?
So we are contemplating two specific projects dealing with copper nickel mining up on the Iron Range. PolyMet, which I know the caller is not asking about, but I think this is important. PolyMet, an open pit mine up in Hoyt Lakes, who has been seeking a permit now for more than a decade, going through that law and that permitting process. And it's likely that they will get a permit before this election occurs. My job as the governor, and I want to be really clear about this, it is to follow the law and enforce the law and use that and not politics to guide our decision making. The Twin Metals Project is a different project. It's in a different watershed. It's in federal land. It is a different decision-making process. And I will say more skeptical about our ability, the state's ability, to permit that process. But they should be able to go through the permitting process and use that tool to inform us, as well as what we may learn from PolyMet as they proceed if they get their permit. I know my job as the governor of the state of Minnesota is to protect our clean water, to protect our future, and to look out for people's jobs. And I will do that, and it's not a blind trust that I have in the law. But when politicians choose to circumvent the law, go around the law, or change the law mid-process, it really destroys people's faith in a process that we need to rely on here in the state of Minnesota. So we're going to learn from PolyMet. It's going to inform us if our laws are not strong enough, then the legislature will change those laws to make sure that they are. My job is to enforce that law, to follow that permitting process, to protect our clean water. And this is one area where Minnesotans feel they're very clear, right? Clean water across our state is a priority for people. It's a deeply held value. And there are things that are threatening that. Copper nickel mining is one potential. So is some of the ag practices that we're experiencing, and we're seeing water impaired in the southwestern part of the state. So is the way that we salt our highways and our freeways. And I think we should be doing more to invest in research to find better solutions for some of these issues. If we together believe that clean water is a value, and it is for the people of Minnesota, and investing in research is a core function of our government, and we can do that at the University of Minnesota and at the Natural Resources and Research Institute, and find better solutions.
If you've just gotten in on the show, you're hearing State Representative Erin Murphy in the studio one-on-one taking your calls and questions. She's, of course, the DFL-endorsed candidate for governor. If you missed Jeff Johnson yesterday, you can find it on the podcast. You can listen to this show on the podcast. And Tim Walz will be here tomorrow. Lori Swanson, Tim Pawlenty haven't scheduled a date yet, which is disappointing. So call them up and suggest that they come on the show. But you can find these conversations on NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen to podcasts. Do you feel that Minnesota companies get too many subsidies from state government?
Well, I do believe that, you know, when you think about our tax code in particular, it has a lot of loopholes in it that aren't necessarily evident to the people of Minnesota. And so when you look at our tax rates and then the loopholes that are in our tax code, it does mean often that Minnesotans, middle class and working class Minnesotans, are paying more for taxes than many of our corporations are. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think that they probably, you know, if we take a look at it on balance, and I was on the tax committee, used to, you know, study that tax incident study. I think there's a fair case to be made that they do enjoy a number of subsidies.
So one issue, Murphy administration might dial back on some of those subsidies, or what would you say about this specifically?
So, you know, I want to make sure that we are investing in Minnesotans and the things that build our future.
But companies could make the same argument, right?
Amazon is a really good example, right? So Amazon asked states to bid on bringing their business to a state like this. And there were a number of questions that I felt as a candidate for governor we needed to answer. Were we ready for that? Was our workforce ready for that? Are we ready in terms of housing? Are we ready in terms of transit? What would it mean for the companies who are already here, for Best Buy, for Target, entities that have built their businesses here that would be competing and competitors to Amazon? What would it mean if we offered a significant outlay of public dollars to a company to attract them here for Minnesotans, and what else could we do with those dollars? Same question around the Viking Stadium, right? Same question that one of our callers brought up earlier, Joe, talking about Destination Medical Center. And I think every time we think about subsidizing a business, we have to think about what it means. What is our commitment to Minnesotans in that, right? When we did reinsurance to the health companies here in the state, the health insurance companies here in the state of Minnesota, we didn't ask anything from them in return. So it isn't necessarily it's too much or it's too little. But for that outlay, what are we getting in return that contributes to the public good, to the common good, and really builds the people of Minnesota? Because that's my aim.
I thought we were going to get a question about this, but we didn't. So I'm going to ask it about broadband, because when we had a show a couple weeks ago about rural Minnesota, this came up as a huge issue here. Do you have a specific plan for improving broadband access in rural Minnesota? It's a stubborn problem.
As a matter of fact, I do, and we're going to announce it a little bit later this week, so stay tuned.
Can you give us just a preview?
Well, I'm really committed to completing the promise of broadband across the state of Minnesota.
Why do you think it's been so hard to complete?
Well, you know, honestly, Carrie Miller, I get frustrated with the political rhetoric that inhabits our campaigns that then evaporates when we get into the work of the legislature and into the work of governing.
Well, Governor Dayton promised to complete this, an ally of yours.
He is, I mean, and I'm so proud.
Is he one of those politicians who doesn't fulfill the campaign promise?
I am, one really proud that Governor Dayton has endorsed our campaign, and I think he, he's done awesome work for the state of Minnesota, and he knows I'm ready to do the job because we've worked side by side. And I am ready
but
to do this job,
he
Carrie
wasn't
Miller.
Able to
and
fulfill that promise, right?
As a candidate for governor, I want people to hear this, right? It's just really determined about this, that we have to restore Minnesotans' faith in our politics and bring them back to the kind of politics that I was raised with, the kind that focuses on us again, the kind that is about us and about our future. And when we make commitments to do things, then we got to follow through. And I know that one person, one individual, one governor by himself or herself can't make a legislature act. But I want to stitch us back together again. I've made this commitment to open up regional offices when I get elected. It's time for us to go back to the people, to make sure that we've got our finger on the pulse of the people. And I've been doing this for 12 years. Minnesotans have been my very best teachers. And there's a real disconnect between what they're talking about. And broadband is a good example. We need it for education, for our schools, for healthcare, for commerce, for our connectivity as people together. We need to finalize that plan. And we need to put forward a proposal, and I'm going to a little bit later this week, so you'll see it. That makes that commitment to finish it up, just like we did with electrification, because it's fundamental to who we are now.
Really grateful you came in to do the one-on-one interview and you took all the calls and the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Best of luck. If you missed that conversation with Jeff Johnson, you can find it on the podcast tomorrow. Congressman Tim Walz in studio. And as I've said, hoping that Lori Swanson and Tim Pawlenty will also agree to a one-on-one interview.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.